Chapter 32. Happy Families. I continued to share my life with Jan and Greg Sims, in the small wooden house we had recently rented in Gipps Street, Birchgrove. As we all had full-time jobs, we came and went from the house as our work hours required. Out of work hours, we enjoyed the freedom the little dwelling gave us. A combination of cute living spaces, and a backyard for creative activities. With the energy and enthusiasm of youth, we painted fabric, entertained friends, and threw parties. Away from Gipps Street, my incomprehensible secretarial studies at the Metropolitan Business College had faded into the background, as I was having so much more fun focusing on the fascinating art-related projects that were part of my job with the National Parks and Wildlife Service. To top up the coffers, I also had a waitressing job in the evenings, at one of the early family eateries at Gordon, on Sydney's North Shore. But our cozy domestic routine was disrupted, with news of my mother's imminent arrival in Sydney on 3 months' leave, from her job in the New Guinea Highlands. My brother had also returned to Sydney, having separated from his wife, and three children, in Toowoomba. As he was homeless and jobless, my mother offered him shelter from the storm, at her recently purchased two-story terraced house in Glebe, an inner-city suburb of Sydney. I was invited to join them, in a brave attempt to recreate the home we'd lost when our parents went their separate ways, and I decided to give it a go. Our family effects were in storage. We had packed up the contents of the house when we came down from New Guinea for my brother's wedding in mid-1961. He was marrying a North Shore socialite with country connections. The wedding was to be held in the chapel at Scots College, Bellevue Hill, my brother's old school. It was a grand society wedding, and as a 12-year-old, I was thrilled to be included in the razzmatazz of the numerous prenuptial gatherings that gave both families the opportunity to check each other out. There were numerous shower tea parties too. I loved it all. And was beyond excited to know that I was to play a bit part in this event as the junior bridesmaid. After the wedding, there was a slap-up reception for 120 family and friends at the posh Wentworth Hotel in the city. It was a magical evening for me, because my father had flown in from New Zealand to be part of the celebration. After the wedding, my mother and I packed up and stored the contents of our family home, because we were returning to our new life in Rabaul. But I digress. Back to the Glebe House. The furniture and tea chests that had been in storage for 8 years were delivered. I began the homemaking process by cleaning the house, then arranging the furniture, unpacking the tea chests, washing, drying, and putting away all the kitchen paraphernalia, in readiness for our mother's arrival. My brother came and went without offering to help in any way. I resented it, and said that I did. The unexpected result of speaking out was an unpleasant physical blow-up, after which I got away to seek help at the Glebe police station, just around the corner. As I tearfully related my story, the duty sergeant remained seated with his feet on the desk. When I'd finished, he smiled knowingly and told me to go home and forget about it. As I left the police station, alarm bells were ringing in my head. It was very clear that expressing my opinion around my brother could again put me in physical danger, and there was nowhere to go for help. But I wouldn't be silenced. I decided then and there to opt out of my mother's dream of recreating a home for herself and her adult children, and returned to live with Jan and Greg at Gipps Street, where I knew I was safe. In spite of the turmoil swirling around me, I knew I'd soon be escaping the drama to spend Christmas in Nairobi with my father and Alison. I also knew it would be my third and last visit as a dependent because travel funding provided by the United Nations would end when I completed my secretarial studies at the MBC. But, as I'd been playing hooky for months, I knew a time bomb was inexorably ticking. It went off with a bang when my father received my end-of-year report card from MBC. he discovered that I'd ignored his well-meaning directive to gain secretarial skills for a possible future career as an office worker. The matter concluded swiftly and cleanly, when I received a telegram making it clear that disobedience and deceit wouldn't be tolerated, along with instructions to immediately return my airline ticket to Qantas head office. As I was no longer welcome in Nairobi, I'd instead spend Christmas in Australia. This sudden change of plan wasn't such a bad thing, as I'd recently made the acquaintance of one Charlie Smith, who frequented the house across the street, owned by his sister Maggie and her husband John. As Charlie and I became better friends, I spent more and more time with his family. Their house was a solid double-fronted Edwardian cottage, awaiting renovation. Below street level there was a huge gloomy basement, the full width of the building, which was reminiscent of a baronial dining hall, with a massive fireplace at one end. Maggie was an amazing cook and John a great raconteur and wine expert. Their combined passions resulted in regular dinner parties on an impressive scale. I loved the eclectic group of people that gathered to enjoy their expansive hospitality. Academics, engineers, medicos, historians, economists, and artists. In November that year, I turned 21. My compulsory savings account had accrued $1,000, and I was sorely tempted to blow the lot on a calf-length grey Arctic fox fur coat. The idea wasn't original, rather a lift from fellow artist and work colleague, Helen Ashton, artist Julian Ashton's granddaughter, who, before departing for New York to marry an American filmmaker, had done just that. My mother managed to restrain me, as she was determined to keep my feet on the ground. Instead of a fur coat, she encouraged me to consider buying a house. At the beginning of 1970, I changed jobs. I began working with the exhibitions department of the Australian Museum in College Street, Sydney. My parks and wildlife boss recommended me for the job. An exciting 3-month contract as part of the team setting up the bicentenary exhibition, titled Cook, Banks, and Australia. My skill set was used to prepare silk-screened didactic wall panels. To help set up displays and generally make myself useful. We watched with pride as the princes, Philip and Charles, opened the exhibition on the 1st of April, that year. Whilst at the museum, with my inheritance in mind, Charlie and I discussed the prospect of buying a small inner city terrace house, and trying our hand at renovating. But before we could do this, I needed to find a permanent job, paying enough to cover 2 mortgages, as well as renovation costs and living expenses. Thankfully, my luck held. In the Sydney Morning Herald Saturday Classifieds, I discovered the Argent Manufacturing Company was looking for a packaging designer. During the interview, I learned that this well-respected firm of high-quality cosmetic packaging printers was prepared to teach me all I needed to know about packaging if I accepted the job. And I did. Now, with a generous salary assured, Charlie and I went house hunting. We found a single-story, 4-meter-wide brick terrace in Yonge Street, Annandale, for $9,000. It was the third terrace in a line of 6, and perfect for renovation. And so began our crash course in renovating. Charlie had previously worked with an electrician, so in addition to a complete rewire, when the time came, we also planned to install fancy wall-mounted bracket lights with the wires chased into the brick, dimmer switches and a trendy hanging corner light. We wallpapered most of the walls and laid mustard-colored wall-to-wall carpet. Golly, we thought we were flash. The renovation took us a little over 18 months, after which Charlie decided to go back to university at night to complete his commerce degree. All the while, I continued to work at Argent Manufacturing, where I remained for some time after our relationship came unstuck and Charlie moved out. But I'm getting ahead of myself, because there are some amusing renovating stories to tell before I move on to my next romantic encounter, that would be the most significant of my life, though I didn't know it at the time. On reflection. Domestic violence. The indifferent response I received at the Glebe police station when I sought help after my brother assaulted me, taught me a very important lesson, that is to quickly remove myself from potentially dangerous situations. A lesson well learned, because by doing so, I've avoided trouble either in or out of a relationship, even though I've occasionally found myself in some pretty wild places both here and overseas. My father. I knew the MBC fiasco would end badly, because I had arranged for my progress report to be sent directly to my father in Nairobi. As a result, it was inevitable that my truancy would come to light, and it was only a question of when. But I didn't care. To be honest, I'm surprised it took so long. Up until this point in time, I'd willingly played the role of the perfect child of a broken marriage, my futile attempt to transcend the shame I carried concerning my parents' divorce. But after the humiliation of my father's, "You have no talent," pronouncement, something snapped. I asked myself how could this be true after 3 years of full-time study at the National Art School. Had it been a complete waste of time? I didn't think so, and this was confirmed when I landed an exciting graphic design job with Parks and Wildlife. Over time, my rage had gradually swelled to the point where compliance morphed into defiance. The worm had turned. Since 1969, I've had one brief telephone conversation with my father. He died in 1993, aged 85. Yonge Street, Annandale. The skills I acquired on the Yonge Street renovation were invaluable, and later put to very good use. I've recently sold my fifth renovation. Charlie. Reflecting on our 2.5 year relationship, I realize we'd little in common other than renovating. After completing the renovation, we followed our trendy friends into the weekend dinner party lifestyle of the 1970s. But it wasn't long before the novelty wore off, and I was left wondering what, if anything, we'd do next. Marriage and children weren't discussed, for which I'm grateful, as I had no interest. I already knew there was a whole world out there to be explored. In my teens, I'd often traveled overseas to visit my parents. Regular trips to visit them, one in New Guinea, the other in Kenya, had left me with an irrepressible urge to continue traveling. It was simply a question of how. Facts. My brother's wedding. As it transpired, my brother's wedding in mid-1961 was the last time all four members of my birth family were together.